episode of the Thank God for Bitcoin podcast. My name is Jordan Bush. I'm the executive director of TGFB Media. And today I am joined by a good friend of mine, great friend of mine, Oshawa Hawthorne. Oshawa, welcome.
What's up, Jordan? Glad to chat with you.
Yeah, go ahead and introduce yourself.
Hey, man. Yeah. Well, I live in Portland, Oregon with my family, and my journey into Bitcoin began largely about 4 years ago, and it's been in Bitcoin time. It kind of a lot happens, and you dig down deep really quick, and so it's been quite the journey. But serving ministry, I've been in both church work and more mission work as well, and I'm kind of in the entrepreneurial and mission space right now, trying to support kingdom entrepreneurs in our city and globally.
Specifically, you're the head of Brilliance Labs, which is doing a bunch of cool things, including recently, some exciting Bitcoin stuff that we can. Actually, you were just on an episode of our podcast not too long ago. Go listen to that episode if you haven't listened to it. We're with Oshawa. He's talking about the intersection of Bitcoin and Christian mission work. So today, Oshawa, today you are here because you and I, as people who at least semi-vocationally work in Bitcoin and have conversations with Christians about Bitcoin, occasionally, every once in a while, I mean, this isn't true always, but occasionally we find people, Oshawa, who don't just immediately go out and put all their life savings in Bitcoin. I mean, perish the thought, but I mean, it has been known to happen, you know, that people have objections to Bitcoin. So what we want to do today is we want to take 10 of the most common objections that we receive when we talk to people about Bitcoin and just break them down, all right? Because what we have found is that there's things that sound super plausible, you know, initially, or they might even be intuitive. They sound like, oh yeah, that makes sense. And then when you push back on them, and when you kind of ask further questions, you get to realize, man, there actually is an answer to this, or that actually isn't as compelling of an objection as I might have thought in the beginning. So do you have anything else you want to add, or do you want to hop right into this?
Yeah. But just that I think it's important that we come at this not as like Bitcoin apologists. So like in the Christian space, you can get into, yeah, like gospel apologetics, and you take, well, we could do this, the top 10 like issues that people have with Christianity, and do like a Reason for God series where we're going to address these common questions. And in that arena, like, it's important, like, so we have conviction. I know Jesus rose from the dead, that he has all authority in heaven and on earth, and that the Bible is authoritative. I can have strong convictions, but also there's plenty of mystery, and it's okay to be like, honestly, I don't have the answer to that question, or that is a challenging, like there are real like challenges and complexities here, and to feel free, like living in that like where there's ambiguity and mystery. So our conviction about Bitcoin is of an order of magnitude less than our conviction about the Holy Scriptures, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So we don't want to go about it with the same level of this like apologetics, perfect, I got an answer for everything. But I would also add, there is a level of mystery. There's a level of, I don't understand everything. And obviously, we don't understand the future. And so I think a good posture is to be like, yeah, there's like FUD, right? The fear, uncertainty, doubt that you get from mainstream media. And this is the basic, let's debunk the stupid narratives that the mainstream media is incentivized to tell you about Bitcoin, the same way that you're going to get stupid FUD mainstream media stuff about Christian faith or about politics, right? So we could deal with all the surface issue, like, dude, this is a really easy question. That's a stupid like idea. Here's why.
Yeah.
But as we get deeper and you get down the rabbit hole, right? There's plenty of mystery and there's plenty of unknown, and so I think it's important for us to be able to be like, you know what? There is complexity here, and And we come at a posture of like, we're observers of this phenomenon of Bitcoin. And we have some convictions about it, but there's also plenty of unknowns that we're like, I don't know. Like 5 years ago, when we had been talking about nation state adoption and presidential candidates coming to Bitcoin conferences on a, and like campaigning on a Bitcoin like policy. No, like no one thought that. But we also don't know what next year holds with regulation and all. So the one thing I want to say is let's have a posture of like we're observers. We've learned some things, but we're not trying to remove all mystery and all unknowns in this process.
Yeah, and I think the thing that I would add to that is again there's obviously unknowns, like we don't know the future. So these things are not going to address, you know, in a bulletproof nature. Like what we're not saying is that there's nothing that could possibly happen for Bitcoin to fail. Like that'd be silly. But what we are saying is, and what we are going to say is, all of these objections have real answers to them, and not all of these are equally convincing or equally problematic, as we're going to talk about with at least one or two of these. There's one or two of these that people very passionately make these cases, and I just want to say, yeah, but you're basically making a mountain out of a molehill, and you're missing the forest for the trees, you know. And so that's kind of what we're gonna do. So let's, without further ado, I appreciate those caveats. Without further ado, let's launch in. So objection number one, we get this all the time. Oshawa, Bitcoin was just created out of thin air, and it doesn't have any real value. Its only value is speculative. It's like, you know, tulips in the Netherlands, you know, in the 1700s, or it's like Beanie Babies. Bitcoin doesn't actually have value. What say you, sir?
Yeah. So I think this objection really had legs about a decade ago, or like, right. So it was an internet Beanie Baby, early on. And obviously you have different market participants, and you have the founder and some other very early like cypherpunks that saw the future in it. And I like, wow, this is gonna transform the like global currency. Some people saw that, but I think most people that jumped on early on, right, they were this is kind of fun, this is cool, I have an internet currency and I have a wallet and I can hold it there. And like you can look at what people traded it for back then. I know we'll talk about drugs a little later on, but like it was novel and fun and then it would shoot up in value, and you have what looks like a tulip kind of craze where you have FOMO and people jump in, and then you have a crash and you're like, oh yep, that's what it was. And you could explain it away as this craze, like, oh yeah, it's just these Pokemon cards or these, Beanie Babies, and yep, now it's dead. Uh-huh. That explains it. And then you'd forget about it. Yeah. And then it comes back 2 years later and does the same thing again. And you're like, huh. And then it crashes. And then it comes back a few, like 2-3 years later, and does the same thing again. And you're like, okay, at what point, and this is what I would say to people that are like, okay, well, it is just a bubble. It is like, it's not a serious asset. I wouldn't take it seriously. I wouldn't invest in it. It's too risky. And you know, it's been through, what is it, 4 cycles, going on 5th cycle? Mm-hmm. So it's like, just the follow-up question is, how many cycles before you change your mind? Like, what's your number? Do you want to, is it 40 years? Is it 10 cycles? Or, because we're going on 5. Like, your answer was relevant, yeah, like 2 cycles ago, 3 cycles ago. But like, at what point do you have to give up that thesis that it's just a bubble, it was created at thin air, and so has no value?
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's one part. So we have to like parse this a little bit. We probably should have parsed this into 2 questions, because like the fact that it's like the Tulips and Beanie Babies, again, what was happening there? You had a mania due to, again, you had this largely, you know, novel. Again, the value of those things was very subjective because you're talking, you know, you're talking the public just liked them. There were aesthetic things about Tulips and about Beanie Babies. There's aesthetic things that people liked. They valued how they looked, and you know, they were associated with different people. There wasn't, you know, these were not, you know, commodities in any kind of real sense. They were effectively, you know, you can grow an endless supply of tulips. You can produce an endless supply of Beanie Babies. There's no inherent scarcity, you know, built in there. Bitcoin is just fundamentally, you know, different than that. Like, there's Bitcoin works in ways, you know, that are fundamentally different than that. So that we could leave that for one second, because then the other set of things, even among people who, you know, don't think it's Beanie Babies, can still think it's created out of thin air, and it has no value. And so I think this is what I would probably start there and just basically say, you know, Bitcoin, it was programmed, okay, if you could say out of thin air, it was programmed, but accessing those programmed Bitcoins can't just happen out of thin air. You can't just decide to get one of them. There's only two ways to get Bitcoin, and that's either to buy specialized mining computers to, you know, to basically run the Bitcoin software. You also need a place to store them. You need somebody to fix them when they break down. You know, you need to pay for the electricity to run them. All of these things. You there's real world costs to mining Bitcoin yourself. Or the only other way to get Bitcoin is for someone to either sell, or for you to buy it from somebody else who's already done that process. Or again, I guess there's a third one. Somebody could give you Bitcoin. But in any of those events, there's real energy sacrificed to produce that Bitcoin and to put it out into the world. There was real either or choices made. And so it's not just being created out of thin air. It's not just that it doesn't have value. It actually does. And so again, you could also look at this from the standpoint of, you know, what does Bitcoin do? There's people for whom they're like, you can't really buy anything with Bitcoin. You know, what is, you know, how does it really have value there? And so, you know, you look at this, you're like, okay, well, what is the value? What is the value of being able to send money across the world with no counterparty? I don't need to ask permission. I can do it on a Sunday at midnight. You know, I like, what is that value? And obviously, what is that worth? And that depends on who you are. But that's an incredibly valuable proposition. The other thing, so that's Bitcoin, the investment, or like Bitcoin, something as like a store of value. That's not even touching on the value of the Bitcoin network. Bitcoin as a way to transact with people on the other side of the world. It can, you know, anybody who wants to, who has internet, can participate in this thing. What is the value of a monetary network that can connect 4 billion people, you know, basically immediately? That's another thing that's incredibly value. And we could, you know, if you want to talk about network effects, Oshawa, you can go into that a little bit and kind of unpack that.
Yeah. Well, so network effects, right? This basic idea that the value of your network grows with each new participant. So when your grandma finally joins Facebook because enough of her grandkids are on it and enough of their pictures are there. So she's, okay, I got to figure out this newfangled thing that all the kids are doing. Now, I don't know if any... grandmas aren't getting on TikTok yet. So yes, the value of the Bitcoin network grows, and it's grown over time. And you can simply look at adoption curves and network effects. You just say, well, there's a value simply to the user base. If I know, so if my raw milk guy accepts Bitcoin, or my rancher, or my buddy, or like if there's people in a network that say, I will use this currency, I value it, and I will do business with you, well, that has value now. And that brings in the social component, and then the other, and these are all these we call them rabbit holes. You're going to go deep down. But if you study and ask the question, what is money? And you get into the like the Austrian economics concept of a neutral money, an idea that a money emerges from the market, then you realize, wow, this is entirely natural and to be expected. So this out of thin air idea, actually, only fiat money has emerged out of thin air, right? Fiat means created from nothing by decree. So the government does that. When the Federal Reserve pushes a, adds some zeros and pushes a button on the keyboard, when they loan out money through treasuries, they're creating debt in a system. They're printing money digitally. So that is out of thin air. But when you have a currency that emerges like organically over time through the natural market tendencies and processes of this is a money that works to, right, to exchange value between mutually like a beneficial relationship of participants, then it grows. So I would say Bitcoin was not created out of thin air. It was created as the summation of like 50 years of computer technology and thousands of years of the evolution of money going all the way back, right, to seashells, to precious metals, to coinage. It's actually the I don't want to say culmination because it automatically assumes I know it's the end of that evolution, yeah. But it is the next innovation, yeah. And the next step in the innovation of money, taking like a physical scarcity and creating and making it digital. And then since it was created, then it's evolved and grown, both in its protocol, be updated and improved. Right. And with the network growing, you now have this evolving phenomenon and this network that the market is saying, the market participants that are entirely free,
yep,
are saying this has value.
Yep.
So to say that it has no value because it's created out of thin air is to say the market participants, and there's millions of them globally, they're all wrong. Or they're all self-deceived, or they're all lying to each other and to everyone else.
Numbers, you know, like that's...
Yeah. There's a market, and I can sell my Bitcoin today, and there will be a market for it. And it changes and goes up and down, but it's there, and it's real.
Yeah. Yeah, and this is, again, so I love that you keyed in on, again, we need to be careful about getting the digital beam out of our own eyes, right? Like the fiat folks, the people who think that, oh, you know, the dollar or other fiat currency, that's real money. Like those are the things where, again, you can take most fiat currencies are created digitally. The overwhelming new creation of those currencies is created digitally. But the fact that you can take the same piece of paper, okay, and write, you know, print on it 100 or one, okay, it's about the same amount of ink, same amount of paper, you know, that thing can be worth 100 times more, 1,000 times more, just by virtue of putting different ink on it. Is, I mean, that is creating value out of thin air. It's the definition of creating value out of thin air, which is a big problem. Great. So again, not created out of thin air. It does have value. Again, try to, if you object to this, try to go get a Bitcoin. Try to convince someone to give you Bitcoin for free, you know, if it doesn't have any value. Now, of course, you know, as Joshua mentioned, this is all free market. Nayib Bukele, who's the president of El Salvador, ruined what would have otherwise been, what otherwise was a perfect illustration, which as a former pastor, I will never forgive him for, unless he seeks it. But basically, you have this thing where up until El Salvador made Bitcoin legal tender, every single Bitcoin transaction for 10 years, 10 plus years, was voluntary. And now, again, El Salvador forces some of their companies to accept Bitcoin as payments. And so now they're the one place where it's not voluntary. But of course, Bitcoin is going to be, you know, its value is going to fluctuate. Its appreciated value is going to fluctuate given different pressures and given the fact that there's a growing and shrinking amount of people using it on any given day. But over time, there's more and more people who are using it. And so the network, the value of the network, the value of the currency to trade on that network continues to grow with every day that goes by. All right, we're going to move on. Oshawa, we can kind of piggyback this one with that. Oshawa, Bitcoin is just too volatile. It's just too volatile. What would you say to someone who told you that?
Yeah.
So in investment kind of layman's terms, people equate risk with volatility, right? So if you go talk to your wealth manager and you want to automate your investment process, he's going to tell you, hey, do you want higher returns with more risk, or are you more of a conservative investor, right? And it's almost like, here's this thing, you want to increase returns? Well, you're going to increase volatility, aka risk. If you're like, I want low risk, aka low volatility, okay, you're going to decrease your returns, but you're going to have, it's going to be more steady. And basically people are like, okay, I'm young in my retirement account, give me high risk and more return because, right, you don't need your money right away. So you're okay with some volatility on the way up. And then if you're older, you retire, it's like, okay, so move into bonds. Let's reduce risk, thus reduce volatility. And yeah, I get less returns, but that's okay because I'm older. I'm going to be spending my money. So that is like, that's your standard wealth management, like, convenient lie that they can tell you, like, of what risk is and volatility. Because it's just not the same. Like, risk is the chance of having permanent loss of your funds. That's risk. Like, if there's volatility and I'm not selling, it doesn't affect me. Like, there's no, like, I don't, if I invest, and this is also always kind of fun, you talk to people about Bitcoin, and they're like, I'm going to make my first buy, right? And then in the next month, it goes down 20%.
That's just called being a Bitcoiner. That is what happens 100% of the time with anyone I've ever known who bought Bitcoin. And like, welcome to the club. It's just perfect.
Trial by fire. Welcome to the club. No, but then what that does is it tests your conviction, and you have to test your thesis. Either your thesis is wrong about the actual value and the future value of this asset, or the market's wrong. And so then this is another helpful distinction where, so is the market always right about things? Well, it's right most of the time, and it takes its generally available information and distills that information quickly through the market. Yep. But the reality is some people make lots of money on the market. Some people beat the market, quote unquote, because they have information and they have conviction and they have a thesis about the future that ends up being true that's different than the market's thesis and other people's thesis. And so that volatility is, if you have conviction, you know what you own, then it becomes a feature and not a bug. As long as you're investing money that you don't need next month, that you're not going to be a forced seller. Most of the volatility within Bitcoin happens because of hedging and huge margin and like 10x in investing that you're shorting it in one direction, you're going long in another direction, you're trying to get a multiplication on your return. And then you have forced buyers and forced sellers on both sides of that. And so it moves quickly. As long as you're not doing that because you're not a professional investor and have that money to risk, then you can sleep happy. You can be like Warren Buffett would say, yeah, don't buy something that you're not content of holding forever, and you don't have to check the price on more than, I don't know, what, once a year. You're like, okay, well, how is it? And I have some great stories of onboarding someone that is just not into money, not into investing, but sets and forgets a DCA and basically slept through the last bear market. Didn't even know it. And then you like check in, like, 3 years later, how is it? Oh, well, lo and behold, I'm up, whatever, 100%, 150%. Look at that. And like, did you know, by the way, like 2 years ago, you were down 70%? No, I didn't know that. Right? So if you don't need the money, like, get on with life, dude. Like, don't be weird like us Bitcoiners and pay attention to it all the time. You don't have to. No, just live your life and invest your excess cash flow and let it grow and ignore the volatility. Is what I would say.
Yeah. And I think this is a great point. I think the other thing, so again, the question, we want to examine these things very carefully, right? So Bitcoin is too volatile. Too volatile for what? Like this, people often have this assumption that volatility is like this foreign attacking entity that should be opposed at all cost. But like, no, volatility is, it, that just means it's the price of growth. Like if you're trying to avoid all volatility, then die, right? Because like death is perfectly stable. Living things are volatile. This is the reality. This is the example I've come to use. I don't know how helpful this is, but it's helpful to me. Like, imagine an alien came down, okay? Imagine an alien came down, and he started asking you, like, you know, he sees fruit on your table, and he just says, hey, where does that come from? And he sees you eating it, and you explain to him, well, food, you know, food gives you life. And he goes, oh, okay, well, that's cool. Yeah, I mean, that makes sense. So where does it come from? And you say, well, you know, we take these seeds, and we put them in the ground, and, you know, we cover them with dirt, and we, you know, make sure that they get water and that the sun shines on them. And then over time they grow and they produce these plants. And then these plants produce this fruit over time. And so the alien is just mystified, right? He's astounded. He's like, what? That almost sounds like magic. You know, that's incredible. And so then he said, well, so, you know, so they grow and then what do you do? And you tell the alien, well, you know, we harvest them. We, you know, we pull them off the trees, we pull them up out of the ground. And then, you know, we store them, we can some, we sell some, we eat some, And so he's like, wow, I mean, yeah, that makes sense. And then you're able to buy other things that you need. And you're like, yeah, you know, you're explaining it to him. And then he says, well, okay, well, then what happens? And then you say to him, well, you know, then all the plants die. And he's like, wait, what? And you're like, yeah, no, all the plants die. And, you know, they die for a few months in the winter. And then, you know, then they come back. And so the alien says to you, well, so you're telling me that the thing that you depend on for life dies every year? That sounds super volatile. I can't believe you're risking your life by depending on a system that's so volatile that you don't have any kind of bulletproof guarantees is going to come back, you know, year after year. And so again, this semi-humorous, depending on who you are, story is just meant to illustrate that there is a whole lot of volatility that is totally just a normal, accepted part of being human that we just take for granted because we just experience it so much. And again, that's not due to some inherent weakness of Bitcoin. It's due to its immaturity. It still is very young. And again, it's a free market system that no one is making. There's no government saying, other than El Salvador, you all have to use Bitcoin, which would immediately onboard a whole bunch of people and bring some stability to the system. So again, these are a number of different things I would say to this objection about Bitcoin being too volatile. Again, the other thing to revisit something that Oshawa brought up, again, get the beam out of your own eye. The dollar is not just this perfectly stable panacea where you know, nothing's going on. Oshawa, do you want to touch on that a little bit?
Yeah, well, there's definitely consistent devaluation. So having the dollar, it is true that it's stable. In the sense of like, okay, if I get my paycheck on the 1st and I have bills to pay on the 15th, like, okay, my bills are going to be consistent and I'm gonna be able to pay that bill. But you know what? My mortgage goes up every year or two. My taxes on my property goes up. My house and the cost to insure my property goes up and my mortgage gets recalculated. In Portland, our electric bill has and the cost per kilowatt hour is going up. Everything, all the prices are going up on an annual basis, and you start to feel it. And I, in fact, a couple of years ago, they did a like the not the rate on mileage for your business and reimbursing miles. They had to, for the first time in our history, update the mileage reimbursement amount twice in a year. So when you just zoom out just a little bit, just enough, which we all feel it, right? In over a given year or given a given decade, like, wow, like the dollar is, its volatility is just straight down. It's just down and to the right. And unless you have a business or an employer that is going to keep increasing your cash flow up and to the right, or you have a savings mechanism or some kind of investment strategy that is going up and to the right, your standard of living, your purchasing power, your ability essentially, like going back from a biblical worldview of be fruitful and multiply, like take this garden. So God put Adam and Eve in the garden. He cultivated that. He said, hey, you're going to protect this. You're going to cultivate. You're going to enjoy in the fruit of the garden. And out there is wilderness. You're going to now go out, be fruitful, multiply, and your posterity, they're going to go turn wilderness into garden. For us to do that, we need to keep growing our inheritance and the size of the garden under our influence, our responsibility, or you could say our stewardship, our husbandry, right? To grow your family generationally and to have kids, to grow your business, your ministry, your kingdom influence, all of these things, to grow your nation, your city, to turn the wilderness into garden, into city that's has human flourishing and honors God. You need a money and a way to that goes up in value, that expands and grows. And fiat is a headwind, is a drag on all of that, if that's what you're denominating your life and your ministry and your family in.
Yeah, and again, this is something that, I mean, the stated rate of inflation, the stated rate at which the government is, or the, you know, the Federal Reserve is devaluing the dollar, the stated rate, the target is 2%. It's actually ranged anywhere from, if you're talking about the actual rate, from, you know, 15, 20%. There's certain resources like housing and, you know, real estate costs like that, where there, it's actually significantly more than that over the last few years. Again, this is a stated thing. The Federal Reserve is saying we're going to devalue the dollar at X percent per year, 2-3, whatever it is. But then the real inflation can be significantly more than that. This is just the nature of the dollar. This is like what's going on. They recognize this. They're owning up to this publicly. Again, it's also important to say that Bitcoin is not moving in any of those things. Like Bitcoin. So whereas the supply of dollars. There can be a never-ending supply of new dollars added into the system. With Bitcoin, there is a programmatic fixed rate of inflation that will one day stop. One day there will all the Bitcoin that will ever exist will be out in the system, and so we'll reach a deflationary a point at which the Bitcoin will become deflationary and it won't be inflationary at all. So again, some of this volatility, again, it's not when people look at, they see Bitcoin's dollar denominated price flying up and down, and they think that's saying something about Bitcoin. Okay. That is in part saying something about Bitcoin. Part of what it's saying when you see Bitcoin's price rising and falling, what it's showing you is that people are able and for whatever reason need to sell Bitcoin to do other things. And so this is a principle that not very many people understand is that When there's a crisis, okay, when there's an emergency, you don't sell what you want to sell. You sell what you can sell. You sell what you're able to sell. So whereas something like real estate, to sell a property, so real estate is generally a more illiquid, good. It's difficult to sell. Bitcoin, there is a global market for this thing. And so it is able to be sold and bought just at the drop of a hat. And so that plays into, you know, the day-to-day volatility as well. Again, that is a feature, not a bug. That is something that demonstrates Bitcoin's strength and Bitcoin's growth. It's not somehow sort of a weakness or a bug. It's Bitcoin is serving the people who hold it in this way, allowing them to make decisions and immediately get to have those decisions honored. This is something that not very many other things can say. And historically, again, it's been a characteristic of money, which brings us, Oshawa, to our third question here. Bitcoin isn't money. Oshawa, I can't walk into Publix today and buy my groceries with Bitcoin. I can't walk into I can't buy a house with Bitcoin. Oshawa, what say you?
Yeah, so that's assuming a definition of money, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Right. So there's some presuppositions within the question.
Correct.
So it sounds like you're saying, Jordan, that money is the thing that is highly saleable, that I can bring it anywhere, and that person is going to recognize it and give me what I want in exchange for it.
Correct.
And I think that's a good definition of money, right? It's the most saleable thing in an economy. Mm-hmm. It's whatever good or service you have, if you give me that thing, I'll give you that good or service.
Yep.
So that's kind of like, that's the pragmatic definition of money. It's what works in a given situation to get what I want. So yeah, that's 100% true. And in that case, Bitcoin is an inferior money to the dollar for the saleability of it to the given person that you're going to go talk to.
In the United States, all those things, yeah. Correct.
Yeah. Yeah, right now. But I think we need to ask, you got to ask some kind of like foundational questions, as well as looking at the other purposes of money. Yeah. Okay. So if we're going to say, well, a good money is also a store of value, that's where, and then you compare, like, let's say, how much Bitcoin does it take to purchase a house? And there's just a great, kind of just a simple diagram of like, well, whenever, 8 years ago, it was this many Bitcoin. And then 6 years, 4 years, 2 years, and you're like, wow, it's down to about 6 Bitcoin to buy your average house. Well, yeah, just ask yourself, the price of the medium house in America going up or down in dollar terms? Well, it's going way up. And if your savings, like you're saving for your down payment, and you're a good diligent saver, and you're saving 10% of your income for that 10% or 20% down payment on your house that you need, you're moving backwards. Like, if a house is going up, like in some places, 10% a year, well, like, you're not even making progress. And so you need either government, like some great, like, I don't know, Kamala Harris on her debate last night promised that she's going to give whatever X amount of money to home buyers.
It's like $20,000 or something. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Just free government handouts, which, if you remember back in 08, that worked really well. Because then all the prices in your neighborhood just go up by that much. Yeah. But all that to say, for a store of value, Bitcoin is better money if you're saving for a house. And all I don't need even the seller of the house to accept Bitcoin. I don't need it to be highly saleable. I just need it to hold its value while I save it, and then find someone who will buy it.
Yep.
And I know I have a buyer. Any hour of the day, I have a buyer for my Bitcoin. So I have a buyer. And then I just take one step and I say, well, I'm going to sell. I've saved my Bitcoin for 4 years. Lo and behold, I now have enough to do my down payment. Now I sell my Bitcoin. I have the dollars, and I'm going to stay in the dollars as little amount of time as possible, so it doesn't go up, or I mean, so that the value doesn't go down, and my price and my house doesn't go up. and then I sell those dollars in exchange for a house.
Yep.
So I've took an extra step in that trade, but you know what? The store of value aspect of Bitcoin served me better than the saleability of dollars. And actually, I use each for their own purpose. And this goes to the Gresham's law, where a superior money is going to be driven out of circulation because people don't want to give it up. And the inferior money is what is getting spent. So I'm going to actually hold on to my Bitcoin as I have cash flow. I'm going to use my dollars to buy food and pay my utilities and buy gas. Get rid of those dollars because I don't want to keep them because they keep going down in value. I'm going to hold on to my Bitcoin. But then when it's time to buy that house, and when I'm not saying that, I mean, we all need a house to live in. So you do your own economic calculus of whether you're going to rent or buy or how you're going to do that. But if I make that personal decision that I'm going to sell then my Bitcoin to buy this house, Bitcoin served me better as the less saleable but better store of value money.
Yeah. And this gets at, again, the more financial question. We talked about the presuppositions here. So the question presumes in a definition of money. It presumes that, again, this money as a medium of exchange. It presumes that that is the preeminent characteristic of money. Okay. The question is, again, that I would ask is by what standard? What is the standard that these people are appealing to? If we look at Austrian economists look at, and they looked at the history of humankind, history of money, and basically there's three characteristics of money, three uses for money. One of them is as a medium of exchange, obviously, but that's even a secondary reason, a secondary characteristic or purpose. The first one is as a store of value. Now, again, there's all kinds of disagreement over this. There's certain Keynesian economists who prioritize the medium of exchange. But if you think about this, if somebody doesn't value something, then they're not going to trade for it. Okay. So basically, a lot of Austrian economists make the correct argument in my mind that the first thing that something has to have to be considered money, even if it's in money in a primitive state, which Bitcoin is a more primitive state in some ways, it is money. It has to be a store of value. Okay. Then it also, medium of exchange is another aspect that's good. And as those first two processes happen over and over again, and they continue to permeate a society, permeate a global economy, whatever it is, you're eventually going to get to a point where the best, the top dog, the best money is going to also be a unit of account. It's going to be the thing by which you denominate everything else. And so if you're trying to say Bitcoin isn't money because it's not accepted when I go to the grocery store, basically what you're talking, you're looking at Bitcoin, you're saying it's immature. And so, it's not as mature in the sense of being a medium of exchange. Now, here's again, the question is, what do we do with that information? There's some people who say Bitcoin isn't money. It's not a good medium of exchange. Therefore, it doesn't have any value. Or therefore, I'm not going to buy any of it. Okay. Now, that is a different argument, and that makes no sense. So, because again, Bitcoin as not a very good medium of exchange is still, as of this recording, worth $56,000. Okay, so again, Bitcoin does not need to permeate the entire globe and be a medium of exchange used by every person on Earth to be extremely valuable and to continue to grow and to be even more valuable over the next few months, years, whatever it is. That's something that I think a lot of people get confused about. They see, they're like, this is not money. It lacks this level of maturity. And so I'm just not going to bother with it until it's more stable. That is a mistake. Okay, Ashwa, we are 50 minutes in here. We're going to do, let's see, we'll do two more and then we'll call it quits. And then we'll do another five in the next episode. Okay. So, Ashwa, Bitcoin is used for drugs and scams and fraud. That's the only thing that Bitcoin is used for. There's no way you can possibly object to this, but give it your best shot.
So you gotta love the free market, right? And so what if I want to buy an illicit drug and I want to like, so going all the way back to like the Silk Road and early internet crypto culture and stuff. If you're trying to get something illicit and you want to purchase it on the internet and your only other option is, right, you can send cash in the mail, or because your bank is not going to honor that transaction or doesn't want to participate in that transaction. And so some of the free market is going to find a way around that. And it is true that Bitcoin provided that service to people that wanted to deal in illicit material on the internet and buy drugs or whatnot, because some of its factors, right? It can be anonymous and it's permissionless. And so I don't have to ask the bank to approve this transaction. You have two wallets and I'm going to share my public address with you and you're going to deposit to that address and I'm going to verify, okay, I received the funds. Now I'm going to send you what I promised to. And so you have this permissionless transaction. So is that a bug? Is that a problem with this type of money? So if you think it is, if you're like, yeah, people shouldn't be able to do illegal things digitally. So then you have to say, well, we need to outlaw paper money then. Because what Bitcoin allows you to do digitally, paper money allows you to do physically. You ever done a Craigslist transaction? Most people like to do that in cash and in person. Now, think of all the horrible things that can be happening as people use paper dollars that are difficult to track, and they're not like, they don't have your IP address when you do your cash exchange in a Starbucks. So you look at the statistics and like a whole ton of illicit activity happens with paper cash. Any horrible thing you can think of where values exchange, cash is the number one go-to for that thing. So are you prepared to outlaw or personally boycott because of your superior morality? Are you going to boycott cash? Well, no, that's stupid. I've never met someone that would do that. Okay, well, then you can't take the moral high ground on Bitcoin because cash is way worse. Bitcoin just allows you to do virtually what you can do in person. In fact, that's what it's called. It's a peer-to-peer digital cash. The technology was birthed with the impulse and the desire to have a digital cash. That's it. That is on a public blockchain that is does not require permission. So getting across that kind of fake moral high ground that none of us have because we all are willing to pay with a 20, then you got to say, well, there's scams, right? So if I'm looking to trick someone, most of the scams, right, are used because Bitcoin is a digital bearer asset. That means if I have the cryptographic keys in my wallet, like I really have them there. It's not a promise to pay. It's not a number on a screen at a bank account or on a crypto exchange. If you hold the keys, you have the bearer asset. It's like cash in your pocket. And because of that, if you give someone else those keys, or if you hold them in a way that those keys are exposed to the internet and a hacker can access them, well, you just lost them. Or if someone wants to try to hold you like hostage, or they found something wrong in your, they hacked your computer and found some secrets that you're trying to keep hidden and are going to steal your data unless you pay them in Bitcoin. Again, that's digital cash. That's cash is used for activities in which you don't want to ask permission of a bank to send the money. Same reason that like when the people scam you, they ask you to go buy gift cards, and send them those the codes for the gift cards. Because again, it's like a bare asset. You have the code, you have access to those funds. You have the cash in hand, you have access to it. So it's really just the problem is human sin, right? Like the reality is the human heart. And the idea of cash, whether physical or digital, is simply value exchanged without a gatekeeper. And you really have to ask a deeper question. Do I think there should be gatekeepers for all exchanges of value? Well, you know what? That's kind of a, like, you're, if you think so, then you are showing your like, first world privilege.
Yep.
And you're showing that you've taken your personal freedoms to so much for granted, and you've been so like domesticated by this living in freedom and thinking that there will never be a situation in which an authority figure would ever question anything that you're ever doing, and that authority figure is always going to be in your best interest and letting you do all the right good things that you want to do. Which is like actually not the case. And it's not the case in most of the world.
Yeah.
Right. All you just think of the COVID and what went on there in the West. Think about the Canadian truckers. Think about if you're a Christian and you hold to a biblical view of human sexuality, and think about all the things that if the world knew that you believed. If you take your Bible seriously, how quickly you'd get canceled and potentially unbanked for these horrible politically incorrect views that you hold. Or if you think in the future there's a world coming where freedoms are being taken away, or if you think you might ever want to send value to a place where freedom is not secured, you know what? You want to live in a world where there's at least some money in the world that doesn't have a gatekeeper and you don't have to ask permission to support a pro-life ministry or send value to a protester to support them or to a missionary in a closed country.
Yeah, I think it's great points. And this is one of these where, again, there's a lot of things at play here. There's a lot of unstated assumptions at play here, right? It's used by drugs, scams, and fraud. Now, here's the question. Okay, so drugs, scams, and fraud. Now, at the risk of being pedantic here, what is the problem with drugs, scams, and fraud? And what defines, how do we define and like parse out what are and aren't drugs, scams, and fraud? Now, here's why I ask that. So, again, drugs, nicotine is a drug. Caffeine is a drug. Like all of these things are drugs, and there are, you know, like there are people who take that seriously and who avoid them for that reason, or there's religions that avoid these things for these reasons. You know, these things are drugs. Now, the question is, you know, which drugs? You know, Bitcoin was used to pay for on this website, famously the Silk Road. It was used to buy all kinds of other drugs that even today the consensus would be, well, we should probably ban these to some degree. But again, that's a historical reality that isn't even the case today. There's states where they've since legalized all of those drugs, including, you know, Portland was one of these.
I live in a city that tried to legalize all drugs. It has not gone well for us, yeah. Jordan.
Well, exactly. And I'm not saying it would. What I'm saying is like this idea of like what is banned or what constitutes an illicit drug is this moving target. And this is why this is important, especially for Christians. There are a great many countries in which Christianity is considered a drug, you know, an opiate of the masses. It's considered to be harmful and something to be banned and gotten rid of. And so, of course, no Christian is going to say, oh, well, you know, that's the one place where, you know, Christians, well, we should still obey. Listen, the government says it's illegal. We should obey them. No Christian. Christianity's been illegal since the beginning. People have been persecuted and killed, thrown out of families, all kinds of things for believing in following Jesus since the beginning. And so, again, the fact that Bitcoin can be used for something that is considered by at a given place, at a given time, harmful, I mean, that's just par for the course. All right, Ashwell, our last one, going for an hour. We try to keep these things around an hour. Ashwa, here's, and this is this man. I wanted to save this one, but it's the best one we've got out of the remaining ones here. Ashwa, gold, Bitcoin just isn't as good as gold. You know, why would we use Bitcoin? Why should Christians, you know, get into Bitcoin when something like gold exists? What say you?
So I haven't heard it yet. I saw that Jack Maulers did a debate with Peter Schiff on gold versus Bitcoin. I haven't watched it yet, so maybe go and if you want to watch a good debate, go watch that. Yeah, I mean, it's so the same reasons that you might buy gold are a lot of similar reasons that you might buy Bitcoin. And people, and there's actually a growing number of people that would call Bitcoin digital gold. Because if you understand it's essentially its monetary policy, right? Like any government, any reserve bank is going to have a monetary policy. They're gonna make decisions about how they print more money, what they do with interest rates, and in general, they seek to have a largely stable currency, and so. In the same way that a government will have its monetary policy, well, Bitcoin has a monetary policy, and baked into that monetary policy is a predictable inflation rate. And by inflation, I mean new currency being created, and so Bitcoin has this this mining process without going into all the technicals if people aren't familiar with it. But every 10 minutes. As each new block of transactions is recorded, there is this block reward. There's these new Bitcoins that are released into the market through being earned by a Bitcoin miner that they may sell it to pay their expenses. And so you have this inflation rate that has dropped and cut in half every 4 years. And we're now at about, I was like a 1.5% new coins produced annually, inflation rate. So now for the first time, it's actually a lower inflation rate than gold based on how gold is mined, right? You have to expend resources to get gold out of the ground and then to be able to refine it and or at least prepare it for sale and sell it into the marketplace. In the same way, Bitcoin needs to expend resources and electricity to earn that new Bitcoin, and then that gets released into the marketplace. And so within how Bitcoin is designed in its protocol and its code, it is digitally similar to gold in that it requires proof of work to get it out of the ground, and that its supply is predictable. So that means that both for a store of value, both gold and Bitcoin can serve in that purpose. The question is, is Bitcoin better at being gold than gold, or is gold better at being gold than Bitcoin, right? So I would argue that Bitcoin is a better gold, and for at least a few reasons. So one is that it's digital, and gold is physical. Now you can, right, it. So you just think about all the different pros and cons of that. But if you're storing gold, you're not going to be using that for exchanging value. You're going to store it to hold value against the inflation of the dollar. And then you're going to, at some point, sell that gold, or your kids are going to inherit it. But you're going to have to exchange it for value somehow. And Bitcoin, you can do the same thing, only easier, far, far easier. And it is the trajectory it's on as the network grows is that there's more likely that Bitcoin becomes a global, exchange of value, saleable money. That's far more likely than gold somehow again becoming like we're going to go return to gold coins. Like, that's just never going to happen. Even the gold bugs, I don't think that. So in that way, Bitcoin is becoming better money quicker. And just look at the price charts. It's held its value better. Right? Like those that like gold will celebrate. Look, it's up 2% this year. We're so excited. And it's like, well, no, that's actually not that impressive. So I would say gold, Bitcoin is better at being gold than gold is, because it's digital, it's becoming more saleable, and its value increases quicker than gold. But I would say one area that it's still weaker and that it's still like needs to grow into is that issue of volatility and a short-term store of value. Whereas, like, if I go buy some of those gold coins at Costco, next year, like, I think sure that I'm going to at least get what I paid for it, and I'll probably hold my value against inflation. Like that's a highly likely situation. Whereas with Bitcoin, if you want to be sure that you're in the green, you got to push that out 3 to 4 years to say, give me any possibility, and I'm like 100% sure I'm going to be in the green. You got to push that time horizon out. Whereas if I was only saving for 6 months or a year, gold would be a less risky proposition. But then again, honestly, a treasury or a high yield savings account would function better than gold, probably, because I can guarantee my high yield account gives me 5% on my cash, and it's in a FDIC insured bank, as opposed to needing to keep it in my gold and like hidden in my house. So in that case, you know what? There's actually better things than gold for short term holding a value. And Bitcoin is far better for long term. So I'm going to go with Bitcoin or my high yield account.
Yeah. Again, great points. I think another thing that I say to people, so again, there are Bitcoiners who like make fun of gold and think gold's the stupidest thing ever. It's just a, you know, yellow rock, blah, blah, blah. Like we're not counted among them. Like I think gold, again, the reasons why I value gold are a lot of the, I mean, they're the same reasons why gold people value gold. I mean, it's a scarce resource that, you know, requires work to produce. I think that's a very valuable thing, both theologically and just practically. I do think, again, we agree with gold. I own some gold, all of these things. I don't think, you know, you're not going to hear us say gold is completely, you know, we should totally get rid of it at all. What we will say, though, is that, and again, this is where we're recognizing that both gold and Bitcoin have value. The challenge is that a lot of the gold guys want to make the case that Bitcoin doesn't have value. They want to try to make this. There are many and a growing number that it's very difficult to make that case at this point. There are some like Peter Schiff who are still, you know, living in the mania of just saying it's all a scam, blah, blah, blah. That guy was offered to buy Bitcoin at like $1 a coin and has been turning it down for 14 years. It just, that hurts. But one of the things that I feel like this gains me some sort of a hearing and talking to people is like what you're looking at, the difference between gold and Bitcoin is trade-offs. The thing you have to recognize is that there's different trade-offs involved with the two things. And it also, a lot of those trade-offs and your willingness to take part in those trade-offs depends on how trustworthy the system is that you think we're in. If you are in a place where the internet doesn't exist, well, then gold's going to be a great thing for you to hold. Like that's just that's the reality. You know, where Bitcoin requires electricity, and at least at this point, largely, and again, there's ways you can get around that. There's people using shortwave radios to do Bitcoin transactions. But by and large, I mean, just that would be less than ideal. So as long as you've got internet, okay, as long as you have electricity, which again, I totally grant those are two big what ifs. But as long as you have those two things, then Bitcoin is a great option. Now, again, you're sitting there saying, yeah, see, exactly. That's why I have gold, because, you know, if the internet goes down, then, you know, I can still access it. Great. Yes, that's, I'm not saying you shouldn't own any gold. But if you're sitting here saying, if you're spending all time, all the time, years, waiting for this thing that hasn't happened yet, waiting for it to happen, oh, the grid's going to go down, or oh, the government's going to nuke it, you know, whatever. If you're sitting there waiting for this eventuality and you're putting all of your eggs into this basket that someday this is going to happen, like that doesn't seem like a very wise strategy to me. That doesn't seem like you're not diversifying your risk appropriately. And so that'd be another thing. Another thing, again, it depends on the situation you're in, right? So to somebody in the United States who has a big house and plenty of places to hide gold, you know, they could bury it in the ground, lots of, you know, like that, that's a, you know, or they have, you know, a safe deposit box where they can put it. They have, you know, reasonable expectation of, you know, legal protection of private property rights and all this kind of stuff. Well, then, yeah, like that, I mean, that makes sense. The problem is there's many other places around the world where they can't depend on all of those things. They don't even, you know, they can't afford, as you know, a meaningful amount of gold to, you know, make it non-trivial to not lose it. You know, they live in places where they don't have safe deposit boxes. They don't have banks. And so they would have to store them in their house, again, where they could easily be stolen, or carry them around where they could more easily be stolen. Now, these are disadvantages at the very least. Another thing, again, in the most extreme situations, I have a bunch of friends who, you know, were in Venezuela, had to flee the country, had to walk across the border. And for those people, imagine if they try to, you know, they brought what they had with them. So imagine somebody's trying to bring a few gold coins with them, or a bag of silver coins. There were people waiting, was both, you know, just common thieves and government approved thieves in the form of soldiers, who were waiting to charge taxes, or waiting to, you know, basically threaten these people if they weren't going to pay them to leave. And so if you've got a physical currency, this thing that for a lot of people, they're like, this is a pure good, the fact that it's physical, that, again, that feature can quickly become a bug in different circumstances. And so that's another thing to be aware of, whereas Bitcoin incredibly has the ability to where I can memorize my 12-word seed phrase. I can, you know, delete it off of my phone, delete an app off my phone. I can, you know, remove any sign that I have it. I've got it memorized in my head, tattooed on my body, you know, saved in a website in the internet, you know, whatever it is. I can do that. I can cross any border in the world and carry around those, you know, those seed phrases that represent billions, literally billions of dollars. Nobody even knows I have it. I can get to where I'm going. I can re-enter those words into a wallet, and I've got full access to all of my money. So those are, again, these are trade-offs. These are, I'm not saying one is, you know, there's no weaknesses. That's not true. There's no trade-offs. There are positive trade-offs to gold. There's positive trade-offs to Bitcoin. And again, our hope and desire is for again, the Bitcoiners and the gold bugs to be friends. We want to promote peace among those two groups, because again, I think they share a lot in common. They value things for the right reasons. And again, I could totally imagine a world in which we need either one or both of those things. And so I think that I'm sure there's more. Oh, the other thing would be verification. Again, that's one of the downsides of gold too, is the fact that, you know, if you're going to buy any kind of quantity of it, you know, the question is, how sure are you that this actually is gold? The only way to be sure, I guess you can X-ray it now or something. It's maybe not even X-ray, but some sort of similar technology. You can do that. Previous to this, you'd have to melt it down, and still in many places, that's really the only, you know, they don't have the technology to do this other thing, to do the scanning. And so they would have to melt it down. And so then you lose the provenance if you're using a, you know, silver eagle or a gold eagle you know, a gold maple leaf, whatever it is, you're losing out on that recognizability of the stuff. And so again, that can be another challenge. Again, not impossible to overcome, but it's a challenge. It's a real challenge to the daily use of it. I think we'll probably leave it here for today. Those are five of the most common examples we get. We've got five more. We'll do another episode. And then we're going to get into, just to give you a preview of things to come, we're going to do basically some videos, like some response videos, where we're gonna look through a few different people within Christendom who've talked about Bitcoin. And spoiler alert, almost none of them have had positive things to say.
Does their last name rhyme with pansy?
Correct. Yes.
Okay.
I mean, depending on how you spell that, I don't know. You know, that, it may have it may seem to me like maybe there might be a bit of pronunciation differences, but yeah, there's definitely a bunch of guys. So we're going to look at an article by Tim Challies. Tim Challies is well known within Christian circles. We're going to listen to some clips from David Bahnsen. Dave Bahnsen, one of the highest performing hedge fund managers in the country, strong Christian. Al Mohler did a whole episode about the fact that in his mind, Bitcoin has no intrinsic value. We're going to look at listen to some clips from that and react to them. And Joe Carter from the Gospel Coalition has an article that we're going to react to as well. And we'll and then obviously the big daddy of them all, the big boss, King Koopa of the finance world, Christian finance world, Dave Ramsey himself, has said way too much that he not ought to have said that we're going to respond to as well. So be on the lookout for those in the days ahead. Oshua, thank you so much for your participation in this episode. I'll give you the last word before we do our sign-off here.
It's awesome hanging out, talking through this stuff, and I look forward to what's ahead.
Awesome. And again, thank you guys for your continued support of this podcast. Feel free to like, subscribe on every platform that you listen to podcasts on. And again, to be honest with you, it would be a huge help, even if there's platforms where you don't listen to them. Apple is by far the most influential podcast, platform. So like those can disproportionately help us. So feel free to go over there. If you've benefited from this podcast, go help us out by subscribing and liking over there, leaving reviews. Another thing, I just want to thank River. River is one of the sponsors of TGFB. You can find out more information about Bitcoin, even if you haven't bought anything yet. If you're just trying to figure out what is this thing, how does it work, what are the risks involved, how do I use this? River is the place that we recommend for people to go find out more information. Even without buying anything, you can go to the Learn tab on their website and get a bunch of your questions answered. And then once you're ready, you can go to river.com/TGFB. You can sign up for an account there and buy Bitcoin over there. If you do monthly recurring buys, you can do so without even paying any fees. So that's an incredible opportunity. We appreciate those guys. And finally, we also want to thank another sponsor of TGFB, which is CrowdHealth. CrowdHealth is an alternative to traditional health insurance. If you use promo code TGFB at checkout, you can get 30% off. And I think in the case of kids, it might even be more than that. But 30% off per person for your first 3 months. Go ahead and head over to CrowdHealth. You can find out more information. Again, we appreciate those guys. They're doing good work and providing alternative resources in a world that increasingly needs them. In a world full of increasingly difficult and broken systems, they're trying to provide great alternatives to those things. So again, we are grateful for your continued support, and we will see you on the next episode of the Thank God for Bitcoin podcast.